and use it to have a conversation with your doctor. Don't keep a lid on it. Visit IdentifyEPI.com. Brought to you by AbbVie.
The following program is for entertainment and basic informational purposes only. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of Cumulus Media, WPRV Radio, its management, or staff. This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Sowa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Sowa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I am Don Sowa. This is the Money Talk program on a Tuesday. That means it is Get Back to Basics here on Money Talk with Donna Sowa Allard, my daughter, and I. We're both, for those of you who are not regular listeners to the show, we're both certified financial planner professionals. And, I've been doing the show for about a little over 25 years now. Donna, I don't know, how long have you been doing the show now? Two and a half years?
About three, like close almost, to three. Yeah,
almost 3 years.
Started in the summer, so I guess 2.5.
Okay.
We'll go with that.
Now, when I started
doing
the show, were you alive yet? Were you alive yet when I stopped
doing it?
Yes, you were already alive.
I was alive.
Actually, you're about the age of your son.
I was.
That's right.
Wow, that's pretty scary when I think about that.
You know, and
can you imagine Connor here on the radio?
Oh, that'd be fun. And he spends an awful lot of... Actually, we've had occasions where we've had a picture when we were doing some of our major events. I have a picture of him sitting next to me with the earphones on, as well as Grace, of course, who's now five.
Future broadcasters of America.
There you go. And they'll be talking about the financial issues of their generation as it comes in...
Hopefully some lessons will have been learned from ours.
Well, if they can manage to figure this whole, one of the biggest problems of these generations, then when he gets to college age, it won't be $100,000 a year to go to PC.
Yeah, I mean, it easily could be. I mean, we're approaching that. I think they're at like 56 or something like that right now.
And since the cost of education, and this includes, you know, private colleges like Holy Cross, PC and others, growing at about 7% per year. In 10 years' time, when he's age 20.
Yeah, I mean, that would double it.
If it stayed at that pattern. I mean, hopefully you could.
I really hope.
You can't do it.
I'm not going to lie. When you said something to be figured out, that wasn't where I thought you were going. That just adds to the list of major financial issues that need to be figured out in our generation so that the next one doesn't have to shoulder it.
Well, you know, the funny thing is the blessing, the extraordinary blessing that you have is that you were born into and raised into and educated into a profession that deals every day with these problems.
Yeah, we're looking at, you know, practical things, problems that everybody faces that do need to be solved. And hopefully through some of our planning, we can at least address them on a personal level, even if we're not the ones, you know, in Washington or the real problem solvers fixing policy.
Well, I look back now that I'm in my 60s. If I said, geez, when I was your age, if I had the knowledge, the resources and the tools.
Oh, the things you would have done.
That you have right now that you've entered into. Well, that's the funny thing. The question I would ask then is, would I, with that knowledge suddenly, would I have done things differently?
Well, you're approaching it with a level of maturity you couldn't possibly have had at the, you know, back then. So,
but you know, even starting
hindsight and wisdom.
I remember doing the radio. We were on from 6 to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday night. I was on by myself in the early days. Those first 5 or 6 years on the radio alone, and finding that because of the work schedule that came with it, I was still working a 70-hour work week, even though, you know, doing radio and television and a lot of other things, and then trying to, you know, to run a practice at that time. It's really what forced us to expand the firm over the years that followed, because I just couldn't do it by myself anymore, which is fine. It's nice because being a public commentator and a public advisor, which is really what we do here on the radio for free for, you know, our listeners who are out there, we didn't have that when we were young starting out. We didn't have that.
No.
But the thing is, we also had people back in those days who were in their 50s and 60s looking towards retirement. And we were talking in those days at that beginning about the choices that they have and the tools that they have available to them.
But you think, you know, at that time, their choices were somewhat more dictated to them, right? I mean, and when you talk about tools that they had available, it wasn't even close to the same.
Well, how about a Dow Jones Industrial Average under 1,000?
Right, but it's all relative, right?
And today it's 20,500.
Yeah.
Big numbers.
It is. We keep seeing that high, that all-time high, record-breaking.
Well, a week
high.
Or two ago, I was talking about, do you think we'll break 20,000? Everybody's saying, do you think we'll break 20,000? Here we are at 20,500 and change.
It happened awfully fast.
Well, I was going to say, how do we go from 20, almost to 21,000 in such a short period of time? It is the...
I'm going to go with momentum on that one.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, and I keep trying to... If it was entirely the Trump effect, you know, if that was the way that it was working, then I would probably be a little bit worried. You know, I'd be a little bit worried if it was entirely the Trump effect because, I don't know, I hope you, hopefully your microphone was working all the time.
No, exactly.
Otherwise, it sounds like I'm talking to myself over here.
Can you hear me, Dad? Could you hear me through your headphones?
Well, I don't really know. I guess I could hear you because I'm sitting next to you.
But you have your headphones on.
We'll try it again. Talk again.
Can you hear me through your headphones?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? It's like that
good.
It's like that commercial for Verizon. Can you hear?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, the market is doing. I think that what we need to talk about from the perspective of Get Back to Basics is the idea that what is it specifically that drives the market? Because it is not some mechanism. It's actually people. Even though those same people may use algorithms and computers and stuff, ultimately the decision to buy or sell is a personal decision, and it's driven mostly by how people feel, not so much what they think.
Far too often based on feeling. Yeah.
Well, today's Tuesday, so the stocks close higher today, posting record highs again. Investors assessing, today it wasn't necessarily anything that happened at the White House. It was actually the Federal Reserve Chairman Janet Yellen. She was speaking before Congress. And as a result of that, I guess the market got to hear, I suppose, what they wanted to hear from her. And the Dow gained about 92 points. Goldman Sachs, again, contributed the most. S&P 500 up about 0.4%, with financials outperforming. The NASDAQ rose about 0.32%. Apple was the dynamic force of the NASDAQ, reaching another new all-time high. Why do you think all of a sudden,
$2.
You know, here we are... you know, we're only the middle of February, so we're basically 6 weeks into the new year.
And we've had a stronger than normal January.
Why financials? Why do you think? I mean, when people are asking me, okay, you know, should I own healthcare? Should I own financials? We're saying, no, not necessarily healthcare, but definitely financials.
So originally, you know, the first bump that we saw in financials had a lot to do with the election and expectations from a Trump administration, expectations for taxes. However, it's also about interest rates.
Well, interest rates are rising, so being that big banks and small and medium-sized banks are all part of financials.
Yep, you got to remember that interest rates are tied to income for banks, right? When they lend out money, they're paid interest.
Well, the other thing, too, is banks take the money that comes in, and not all of them lend it out. Some of them actually invest it in financial vehicles of their own. Mm-hmm. And since the interest rates have been historically low, and even at the short range, close to zero, all of a sudden, if the Fed fund rate is going up, then perhaps the spread between what they can earn on their money and what they actually lend out.
Right, so that'll widen.
And it turns out, I was looking at some long-term statistics. They said, in periods like this, there's a pretty decent period of time between when the interest rates the banks enjoy are passed on to actually depositors and investors at the bank. Now, the CD rates and money markets don't go up immediately.
It doesn't happen immediately.
So they enjoy a lag time that allows the profitability, the spread at the bank, to be a little bit wider than it would be. And that's a profitable period for them.
Right. And so, like you said, Janet Yellen's remarks today saying that, I believe it was just that keeping interest rates low for too long wouldn't be a wise decision, which we know, right?
Well, another concern that isn't part of the regular discussion every day is the fact that another very large issue, they always talk about the crisis that dealt with subprime mortgages. Now they're talking about the issues with student loans being over $1 trillion outstanding and whether they will be honored. But now the other side of this, too, is the fact that there are a great many pensions out there at the state level, mostly in the municipal levels, and they can't just invest in just anything. And the requirements they have for payout, now that a great many of the baby boomers are now retiring and looking to their pensioner for their monthly checks.
Right. The allocation of the money that they invest is going to be based on their pool of.
And they may not be allowed to be as aggressive based upon the board of directors or the board that is handling each of those pensions. You know, I look specifically at some of the endowments, but I also look at the biggest providers of pensions like CalPERS, which is the California Public system. You know, they have to have a lot of money in fixed income, because they need to honor the income component on things. And, mm-hmm. and let's face it, a large number of the most traditional income vehicles, such as bonds and other securities, are not paying out very much.
Not a whole lot right now. No.
So it makes it really, really, really tough for them. But right now, we're seeing the market go up. Fed Chair Yellen said in prepared remarks that waiting too long to raise interest rates would probably not be wise, given the rise in inflation and economic growth. So we'll see some push there. It was expected of her that she might actually be a little bit hawkish, according to most analysts on Wall Street. And from her perspective, the stock market is, yes, it is at all-time highs. And the economic data is also improving, though. So we're not in a situation where you're seeing markets move to all-time highs, but the economy is becoming increasingly more and more sluggish, like we might have seen back in late 99, early 2000, mm-hmm. when you were looking at price-to-earnings ratios in the 30s and 40s. We're not
far
there yet.
High.
We're in the
far
18 to 20 range, and now that's higher than the long-term average for price multiples, but it is not necessarily
not
as high as we saw during the big crash that happened in 2001 and 2. So, I mean, these are all important things. She, of course, is going to continue to look at the data, but it's pretty prudent, I think, for her to actually start becoming a little more hawkish, meaning thinking that she's that the Fed will likely recommend raising rates. And I'm still a buyer of the idea now the Fed fund rate's around 0.50 right now, that they may get up to 1% at the end of this year. So that would be two quarter point moves, even though they were originally saying three. But that's not built into the numbers, at least not right now. The U.S. Treasury yield ticked higher after her remarks, with the benchmark 10-year note trading right near 2.46 and the short-term 2-year about 1.23. Now, the probability of a rate hike in March is a little bit higher based upon her, you know, what they were saying. I think interest rates are reflecting that, according to Liz Hornby. Lisa Hornby is a fixed income portfolio manager over at Schroders. The probability of two rate hikes this year is pretty good. So at least a lot of the analysts out there are in the same camp that I have been in since the beginning of the year. Not expecting three, but looking likely to two. The rest depends on how the dollar evolves. I mean, the dollar erased earlier losses against a basket of currencies. The euro is right around 1.05 against the dollar, and the yen right around $1.114 yen to the dollar. Janet Yellen really paved the way for the possibility of as many as three rate hikes, with the likelihood of at least two. She's sending a message that they are on their way towards some level of normalization. Market expectations of a rate hike next month rose to about 23% chance. It was now, the 23 may not mean anything, but it was 16% before the Yellen speech. So that may give you some indication that that's a more positive indication that people believe that there will be some sort of an increase. Maybe not in March, but maybe as early as May. Tuesday also marked the first time Janet Yellen had testified since Donald Trump was elected president. The economic data have probably improved since November the 8th, with sentiment and inflation metrics all ticking higher. The NFIB Small Business Index, which measures small business confidence, how confident are the business owners and managers, it's at 105.9, which is probably the best read that we've seen since around 2004. Now, part of the reason for that is that a lot of the rhetoric coming off of the presidential campaign, at least on the Trump side,
was
saying small business friendly is where a lot of that's. I mean, if you bring taxes down, if you make buying domestic, most small businesses are domestic, what we call organic growth providers here, and they are big providers of jobs. And I don't think that there's anything in the Trump philosophy that is more important than the idea of creating good, decent, high-paying jobs. Whether that is doable in this environment or to what degree that it really can be done, that's going to be another discussion. It's going to take, unfortunately, a lot of the analysts who are watching the job picture, it's going to take a little bit of time before they figure out exactly where it lives. Folks, you're listening to
Rotarians Dave Clifton and Rona Mann, Fridays at 3 p.m. here on AM 790 Talk and Business. This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Now, Donna, we know about Rotarians. Your grandfather, Jaju,
yes, active member of the Rotary Club.
He was the president of the Cumberland Lincoln Rotary Club, a very accurate club up in northern Rhode Island. And I had him over the house all the time for barbecues and everything else. So always hearing about him. And, of course, he always took the work very, very seriously. I find it fascinating and probably a great idea that they're broadcasting here locally. They're discussing and talking openly about the work that so many of these benevolent organizations.
And say clubs like the Rotary Club, the Lions Club,
Lions,
they are very
myself,
active members in the community and do a lot of good work.
They raise a lot of money for various purposes. Some of them embrace specific causes that are part of their, you know, their moniker, and they raise money for them every single year. And I think it's also a great idea that local business professionals, men and women, will have a place and an opportunity to gather together to discuss issues that are unique to not only the local community, but to the here in the state of Rhode Island and Massachusetts, to the local state issues as well. You know, having been part of one of those organizations, I imagine the conversation over lunch was always fairly diverse.
You know, that's one of the good things, too, is they are local because every area has its own needs, its own population, its own, you know, group of issues to be dealt with in ways they can be helped. So, yes, that is, it is good, and it's good to have it known what's going on with them.
Now, part of what's happening right now in the markets, you're seeing we went through a period where the markets just simply moved sideways for a short while, but now it's back to the upward movement, breaking through 20,000. Now it's up to like 20,500 and change. What we're really seeing out there is, again, speculation about what the existing, what the new administration, I mean, we're only like a month into this, but what the new administration will hopefully try to do. Now, what they're doing is they're looking back at what the words from the president-elect during the campaign, the themes that Donald Trump, you know, embraced, you know, as part of his ongoing point of discussion. One of the issues, of course, would be reforms within the tax code, which is big at both the personal level as well as the business level as well as the global corporate level. And maybe using to some degree, we'll see how this can work out, using the tax code to benefit local business, local jobs, and local products being manufactured here in the United States. Again, the focusing on domestic jobs here.
Well, we should be seeing an announcement about that in the next couple of days. I know he kind of telegraphed that there was a phenomenal tax plan coming, and so now we just await the details, right?
Yeah, well, the other problem with phenomenal tax plans is all tax plans have got to be paid for. And I imagine Paul Ryan.
The devil's in the details there.
Every time Paul Ryan talks to the president, I'm sure he takes him aside and
says, budget, budget, budget.
Mr. President, please, I'm begging you. He must be saying, I'm begging you. He says, remember, some of the stuff, you know, please don't make a promise without at least clearing it with us in our budget people, because we run the numbers. We're telling you what we can do.
Well, I mean, there's it's math. It's a math problem. You either find a way to pay for it between cuts with a cut somewhere else or raising money somewhere else.
Well, the old theory, especially under the Reagan years, which was of course to reduce the taxes, give an incentive for people to work hard,
invest in business, raise more money, and invest.
Granted, the problem with and of course it was to call Reaganomics, trickle down economics. Those who critiqued it, criticized it, indicated to it, even if to some degree it should even work, it takes years and years for that trickle down to actually occur.
I mean, it takes years, and I think that it shows that it doesn't, let's just say, trickle down evenly. It serves to, you know, benefit a certain part of the population more so than others.
But the president's talking about it, and the public and the markets like to hear about it. But one of the things that you and I talk about often, the old phrase used to be the market buys on the rumor and sells on the news. But I've stopped using those two words, rumor and news, instead say.
And you have new words.
It buys on speculation and sells on reality.
Yeah.
And so right now, when the president talks about an upcoming phenomenal tax plan, well, we don't get any details with it. And that was the one complaint I had during the campaigns, that I used to say, you know, I'm listening to the Trump plans or the proposals he's offering, and some of them sound very, very good. The problem I have, though, because I come on the radio and people send me letters here and they say, Donald, please talk about the Trump tax plan or talk about this one. What does it mean? What is it going to do? What's the potential?
You have no idea.
And I said, I've got no idea, because we're not getting any details. Even people that would write to the Trump campaign headquarters, and they would refer you to their website or whatever, and basically it was the same talking points that you were hearing out on the road. There were no details with it. It was just, this is going to be really great, it's going to create jobs, it's going to do this, it's going to do that. I said, yes, but how? And what's it going to cost? And the problem is, when you give tax cuts, you've got to raise that money. The money's got to come from somewhere.
Because if it doesn't, all you do is grow your deficit. You borrow it.
Well, that's what happens.
The deficit.
Keynesian economics, which is what they followed, is based upon that, saying that, okay, we're going to borrow the money in the meantime. But then as this fosters new economic growth and people start making more money, because they're making more money, they'll be paying more in taxes. And basically the debt will become a smaller percentage of GDP because the GDP is growing so fast. Well, there's always some truth to that. But the bottom line is the bills still have to be paid up front.
And at this point in time, relying on the phrase GDP will grow so fast just doesn't seem like a prudent thing to do at the stage of the game.
Well, the first real challenge for the president will be coming up in the middle of March, and that's when we actually hit the debt ceiling. So you'll have the Senate and the House, which are controlled by Republicans. But you've got to remember...
So we're not going to run into the same issue?
We may very well run into the same issues, that because they're very big, especially the Tea Party folks, they're into fiscal conservatism, which means they don't want to increase the debt ceiling. They don't want to increase the amount of debt that we can take on as a nation. They're trying to say, show me revenue neutral policies over here. If you're going to do a tax cut, show me where you're raising the money to get the taxes for that purpose. You want to spend money, $1 trillion on infrastructure over the next 10 years? Great. That's a great idea. Everybody likes that kind of stimulus program. But where are we going to get the $1 trillion from? So guys like Paul Ryan are going to be holding the president's feet to the fire and say, look, we like your idea on the surface. Please don't misunderstand. The problem is you're asking us to find the money, and it's not there necessarily, unless you have some other idea. So there is the president's learning, and his people are going to learn very quickly, whether it's dealing with politics, international politics, country to country, or when they're looking at what happens between spending, borrowing, stimulus, and all the things of this country. There's a term called linkage, that very few policies or strategies can stand alone. Every one of them, whether you're buying something, selling something, spending money in certain categories, or raising taxes on another side, they're all done because of some other specific need that the government has. They call it linkage. One decision is linked to another. One country, you're debating your economic deals with one country, your trade policies with one country. Well, a lot of times, if you are too harsh in dealing in trade policy, they may turn around and say, yeah, but you don't understand, Mr. President. We've been assisting you dramatically on the global intelligence side. The amount of information you're getting about global terrorism and this and that comes from our connections in the Middle East. I said, there is more to our relationship than just who gets the best deal when you're negotiating prices, you know, at the border, so to speak. So the president will learn an awful lot about linkage. But it's going to be an interesting dynamic as time goes on. God bless him. He's only 4 weeks into the year. We've got to be patient with him. But at the same time, it's very, very important that we believe that he himself and his people are asking all the right questions of all the right people. And that's going to be an interesting study no matter how you look at it. But that's something that we as a country are going to be learning. We're going to learn a lot about the presidency. We're going to learn a lot about government, I think, as this administration continues, because they're learning as they go. And so hopefully the people that are teaching them are going to be very, very patient, because it can be very frustrating, especially for somebody who's used to getting what he wants just by asking.
There was no internship.
There was no internship for the presidency. Folks, you're listening to The Money.
Intel Core processors. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. Intel inside. Powerful productivity outside.
This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with the second half of tonight's Money Talk program. Now, talking about fundamentals, you know, we talk about what happens daily in the news, and the news on any given day will drive market movement. It certainly will drive the volume that takes place, how much trading does take place, how much buying, how much selling. It's often done based on how people feel. So if the news coming across all of the news wires, whether it's radio, TV, cable, wherever, if the news is basically positive things happening in this country, positive things happening in the world, then that sets a tone. And that tone will get a certain body of investors to take what may be cash that they have just sitting in the sideline and say, hey, I feel pretty good. I'm feeling pretty positive. I'm feeling pretty confident. That's why we keep tracking investor and consumer confidence. And they put that money to work. Now, the problem with it, if you yourself are also looking at the news and making a decision to invest in something that you've done some research on or you've done some work with your advisor on, well, that's a good thing. But a great many people are guilty of investing based upon a different motivation. And it's not really their own research they're following or their own motivation they're following. They're looking at the motivation and research of others.
You know, most individual investors will make decisions not necessarily – everyone likes to think they're objective, right, and that they can look at data and make data-driven decisions. But the majority of individual investors – and by that, I just mean people who are looking at their 401k or looking at their IRA and they have access to go make changes themselves. So they're going to go in and make changes not necessarily – for objective reasons, but what has to do more with what's called herd mentality. And herd mentality doesn't just apply to finance, it applies to many, many things. But it's the idea that, you know, you see other people doing something and it's working well for them. So you then go ahead and do the same thing, expecting that it will work well for you. In, you know, as a consumer, you have a bunch of friends who have gone out and purchased something. They bought cars, and you see someone who's bought a car that works really well for them. They like the features in it. It drives well. They don't have any problems. They've kind of given it a test drive for you. So you go buy that car, and it works well for you too. Herd mentality may work in that situation following, you know, someone else's good decision. But when it comes to investing, if you actually wait to see the good results and follow the herd, very often you get in too late to take advantage or to get the benefit of the rise in price.
Well, the historic trend shows that that period in time where the herd is gaining its real strength, its optimal strength, is usually at the end of the cycle.
It's at the end of the cycle, which means it precedes a drop in the price of that asset. You know, most people who are acting based on herd mentality, they're making decisions. We always say, you know, you buy out of, you make your financial decisions out of greed or fear. That's what very often motivates people. Well, when it comes to making financial decisions based on herd mentality, it's most often out of the feeling of regret. It's that, you know, fear of missing out or the regret that other people have seen price appreciation because they bought that stock first or that fund first, and I've missed out on it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to miss out anymore, so I'm going to get in now before I miss out anymore. But if you're getting in at the very top of the cycle, you're getting in just in time to buy close to the peak and then, should I say, enjoy the ride down? It's not really enjoying the ride down.
Well, you've got to realize it is the desire to participate. In other words, it's the... the sheer
volume. That sounds so much nicer than regret.
It's the sheer volume of buying that occurs out there. It is that volume in the number of participants that have already bought in, hopefully for them, at a lower price. But it is the demand for that product, that stock or whatever it is, that pushes the price higher. So when it gets high enough that the average person or maybe the lower third of the investment group suddenly notices it. They're suddenly noticing how good it's doing, and they hear that phrase, hey, everybody's buying this stock, or everybody's buying into this mutual fund, or everybody's buying this
sector.
You
don't want to mess out on it.
You don't. And that's when you start to feel bad or guilty or even foolish that you're not participating. So you jump in, but you've jumped into a market that has already been driven and motivated by the herd. They've already bought in. And remember, when it's time for them to get out, when the person has said, I bought low, it's time for me to sell high, who are they selling to? They're selling to that other third.
Those buying.
That one third who comes in at the very end, who still thinks there's upward opportunity and they want to get in before it's too late. Well, guess what? As you are getting in, if you're one of them, if you're getting in, the original investors who actually took some risk to get in because they got in before the herd, they were taking some risks because it didn't have to necessarily go their way. But because they did, they now have somebody buying their shares on the way out. Hopefully it's not you.
No, and what you're discussing is precisely the reason that investor performance is always going to be different than investment performance.
Well, they said the last 15 years, the market has done between 6 and 7% average annual return. Now, that even allows for the bear market of 07 and 08, the recession.
15 years, that catches the bottom of the bear market in 2000, 2002.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah. It was...
There's a lot of bad.
There was
there.
Some lousy years in there, and there was some very, very good years in there. But it was the average. If you were sitting in an index like the S&P 500, over that time period, you did between 6 and 7% average annual return.
That means if you were there, sitting there.
So you
right?
could have very easily, if you didn't pull the money out, if you just put it in place and then were patient, you could have more than doubled your money over that time frame. But interestingly enough, who did the statistics, Donna?
Oh, it's a Morningstar report that shows that investor performance for the same time period was, you know, about 2 1/3% lower And it's because people have the tendency to jump in and out.
Well, you know, regardless of how you look at that, that's because of it. You're allowing, because you allowed emotion to drive the decision one way or another. There is a style of investing out there known as contrarian thinking. And what the contrarian analysts do is they look for the areas of the market that are important areas to the economy, but the areas that have underperformed over the last 3 to 5 years. In other words, again, important areas to the economy, but that have underperformed for the last 3 to 5 years for a number of reasons. The feeling is there is a greater chance that by buying into an area that is either in the trough or perhaps about to come out of the trough as part of their cycle, you have the best opportunity to buy low and get in before the herd starts charging. And that at some point when you decide to get out, you were at the front of the herd.
I was just going to say, you're that person who's selling to the last third of the people buying in.
Yeah. And of course, they go the opposite route as well. They're the people that once they've been an investor, when they see a massive trade volume taking place, and these things are tracked by a number of online services that you can actually get on your computer that are actually free. They call them stochastics. Volume of trading, volume of participation within the markets, and they look to see, especially they'll look on, because you can find this online too, corporations that are publicly traded, look at key people that are within the corporation, executives, key shareholders. Are they buying or selling their own shares? Believe it or not, they have to list that with the SEC, and it's available.
That's very tightly regulated.
It's actually available online. That's another stochastic analytical metric that they use to
That's
say,
measured.
So yeah. they figure, well, now granted, there's lots of reasons why people buy and there's lots of reasons why they sell. What you're looking for is not any one person, but the trend. If the trend is to get out, or if the trend is to get in and there's a large number of people in, that may be your point as a successful investor who's just made some money at it. It's your time to get out. And of course, the other way around, the time to get in may be when it doesn't look quite so favorable. Folks, you're listening to the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard, and we will be right back.
Life and powerful Intel Core processors. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. Intel inside, powerful productivity outside.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with tonight's last segment of the Money Talk program with Donna Sowa Allard and myself. I'm Don Sowa. We've been talking a little bit about some of the basic concepts that either drive the success or failure of investors. Emotion having an awful lot to do with it, knowing when to buy, what to buy, knowing that maybe if everybody seems to be buying into a certain sector, maybe it's too late for you to participate, or at least with the type, maybe you're just nibbling around the edges of something you find attractive is better than going in, jumping in with both feet. But Donna, as difficult as knowing when to buy is, most professional money managers and traders will tell you the decision to get out, the decision to sell is even more difficult.
Yes, and one of the reasons that it can be hard is because, again, people make emotional decisions when it comes to buying and selling. And it is not uncommon for people to form some sort of attachment to their investments. I find it more common when it's an individual stock than if it's a mutual fund. People may become attached to mutual funds if they've owned it for a long period of time and the fund itself has done particularly well over that time period. We see that. And that has to do a lot with recency bias, right? You say, okay, well, what I've seen over the most recent years, I'm sure that's going to continue into the future. They don't want to let go of that. But people do sometimes become psychologically invested in something that they've purchased.
Now, if you go online, I mean, especially if you own an individual stock, there's news on the web, MSN Money, Yahoo on Money. There's a lot of news out there on maybe your company. So pay attention to your company.
There's news. Some of it has to do with the fundamentals of the company itself, and other times it has to do with other things that aren't necessarily about how the business is run, but maybe about things happening with like key personnel and things they're saying or things they're doing that maybe shouldn't necessarily have an effect on the health of the company, but they do because that's the era in which we live, right? If a CEO or someone says something, it can turn into something that's a very big deal for the company, resulting in lawsuits, resulting in people not wanting to buy that product and boycotts. There's all kinds of things that actually don't even have to do with the company itself that can affect price. But most of the time, you are looking at things like, how is the stock priced? Is the stock overpriced, that's a concern. So you should have things that you can look at that will be very objective in your mind to say, this is a reason to sell.
Well, you know, some people like to follow what I think is a very good strategy, although it seems overly simplistic. And that might be,
well,
you buy a stock, and then you say, when I double my money over however many years, then as soon as I double my money, sell half of it.
And that's an objective decision. And that sounds like really overly simplistic and probably doesn't even make sense to some people. But when you own an individual stock, there's a lot more volatility than there is if you own a fund, right? It's not diversified. And the stock can go up very quickly. It can also go down very quickly.
But you know, the funny thing is another motivating factor in a lot of investors who have the money to invest, who are serious about it, who want to do well, one of the motivating factors to buying is suddenly having cash available to use to buy. So if you have a stock that has doubled, you sell half of it. Now you're basically now working entirely with the profits. You still have the original position, right?
So you can take that cash and now you have an opportunity to invest it somewhere else that maybe hasn't run up quite so much.
So now you do your research, you get out there, you look at ones that companies you might be interested in, companies you're hearing good things about, companies that may have metrics that look favorable for you and maybe have, let's face it, if you're following them online, you know how many buy recommendations or how many strong buys or how many holds.
That information is easy to get on the financial websites. But I think, you know, aside from your idea of once you double sell, the idea of looking at price targets and looking at PE ratios is important when it comes to, you know, is my stock fairly priced? Is this overvalued? Is it undervalued?
Now, if by chance this is not an IRA we're talking about with the money in it, what else does the investor have to know
about
in terms of the time frame?
You want to be looking at long-term capital gains versus short-term capital gains. And it's a personal decision, but make sure that you know that if you want to get the most favorable tax treatment, you are going to hold it for more than 12 months. So you receive the more favorable capital gains versus short-term capital gains, ordinary income tax rates.
Now, another time that you may choose to sell, even though you're selling at a loss, would be as if you are trying to raise capital for another purpose and you have an asset in your portfolio that has a lot of embedded capital gains. You could sell some assets at a loss, use that to offset the gains, and actually avoid tax liability at all.
Which is a very common strategy to use. Yeah.
So, I mean, talk to your financial advisor about that or talk to your tax professional, you know, because they could guide you into telling you, well, how many shares of this should you sell in order to optimize a favorable tax strategy.
Yeah, I just think it's really important to make sure that when you are selling that it's because of reasons like these. They make sense. They're technical, right? They make sense. They're based on price and value, as opposed to, you know, being afraid that the market's going to go to zero or something like that.
Donna, if instead of this, let's say you're a mutual fund investor, and if you
have a little bit different,
$50,000 invested in 10,000 each into five different mutual funds.
So
what is another strategy that's wise?
Yeah, if you have your mutual funds and the way you just described it, the allocation is equal among all of them.
Well I wanted to keep it simple.
I know. So you can sell to rebalance, right? If you want to keep your account in balance, you had 20% in each. Well, if one area of the market has, and we're assuming that these are very different mutual funds, right? So if you know, maybe your small cap fund has run up really high because small caps have done really well, and another fund has been out of favor, well, peel, you know, your gains off of that small cap fund and buy the lower fund to put yourself back in balance.
I mean, you go through sectors like that. I mean, let's say you own an exchange traded fund that invests entirely in healthcare, and you own one that invests entirely in financial services. Healthcare has done well up until recently, and financial services went through a period that was doing poorly. That could be changing now.
Right. And, you know, if you think about that, this is the most basic rule of investing. It's just that buy low, sell high kind of idea where one is positioned to do well, one has done well. Well, where do you want to be? Do you want to be in what has done well, or do you want to be in what is going to do well?
But trying not to be overly clever or think it through too dramatically, if you go with that percentage type model and say, once a year, I'm going to rebalance back to my 10% each holding or 20% in each holding. You do it automatically. You're selling your winners, using the proceeds to add to the ones that haven't done as well. So you are, in fact, selling high and buying low. And over time, that strategy, dollar cost averaging, has been proven to work.
Well, and really important, too, you just said if you look at it maybe once a year, this isn't something you do on a monthly basis, right? That's far too short of a time frame to be looking at your portfolio and making decisions. This is something that you want to do on an annual, at most, I would say, semi-annual basis, to be taking a peek, rebalancing if necessary. You know, certainly if it's within a tax-advantaged account like an IRA, the decisions are easy. If it's in an after-tax account, capital gains come into play, so your decisions might be a little bit different. But looking on a regular basis and making objective decisions versus following that herd mentality into buying and on the way down and selling, that certainly won't result in the best long-term results for you.
Well, we had, again, another case, although it wasn't about specific rebalancing, but a dollar cost averaging. The person had $100,000 that was in cash. They already owned four funds that they liked, four very different funds that were in different areas of the market. And they decided to go in over a five-year period and take from the $100,000, they automatically took $20,000 each year in January and bought $5,000 each into the four different funds. And the discipline there was to have the willingness to do it each and every year, regardless of the specific performance of an individual fund that year. In other words, some years a particular fund is going to have more holdings in it because it was doing really well. In other years, you're simply going to be buying more shares. And that's really what it is you're trying to do with dollar cost averaging. These are strategies, once you employ them, they're relatively simple. Why they work may be more complicated. But hey, that's what we talk about in the world of money and finance. Donna Allard, thanks for joining me on tonight's show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining both of us on Get Back to Basics Money Talk right here on AM 790. Tune in tomorrow.